Hello, and welcome to Canoeing Quest, episode 409. I can't think of something funny. Conflict. I'm your host, Mike Apps.
I'm in conflict with you.
Yes. This podcast is in incompatible state with your request to listen to it. I'm your host, Mike Apps, aka Wheels. With me as always. I'm trying. It's a hard one to come up with a joke for.
Nahobino of the New World, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
And for once, as we are streaming this live, the feed is up to date. So I wanted to get up to date because it was a post-direct show.
That feels like fake.
No, it's
Would that post the partner direct or post the indie world?
Oh, shit. I forgot about that one. We haven't recorded since the indie world.
Yeah. There was a cool game in there. A few.
I played
the Mina the Hollower demo.
It's the only one I care about.
I don't feel like it's super important, but it does run at 120 FPS if that's something you need.
It seems unnecessary.
It's like it's smooth at 60. It is smooth at 120. You're not going to notice much. But hey, we did see we saw some other things. We got the shadow drop of UFO 50.
Yeah, that's right. I don't care. Convince me to care. Go.
UFO 50 is a collection of 50 fake retro games. That is in that is given the conceit of being the collection of an influential but out of business publisher from the 80s who produced a lot of weird garbage. So all of them are retro styled but have a lot of weird, interesting ideas in them. And there are 50 of them. You are going to like at least one or two of them.
Okay. Interesting.
And it's. I would say that its closest antecedent would be like the Game Center CX game Retro Game Challenge.
I did mildly enjoy that game.
Yeah, it's got games of all sorts of genres in it. There's bound to be something in there that's interesting. It's neat. I'm glad that it's coming out on consoles now. But yeah, it's really neat. I immediately picked that up. There's a lot of just truly weird nonsense on it. But yeah, those were the things I cared about. There was some sort of update to Little Kitty Big City that I was not clear on what that was.
Oh, yeah, but I saw that. It's not out yet, though.
Yeah, that's ongoing. Yeah. There was some other stuff, like a lot of the indie scene and stuff that I don't follow too closely, but it was nice. You know, it's always nice to see some shout outs to games that might otherwise not see a lot of attention. And no Silk Song, stop asking.
That game ain't never coming out, is it?
I think it's probably coming out in like December, but I don't terribly care because it's not for me. But Mina the Hollower is really good.
It looks awesome. That's
Yacht Club. That's Yacht Club's new game. It's sort of like, it's got GBC Zelda vibes plus a little bit of Souls in it. Not a lot, but a little. And there's like a fun like digging and jumping mechanic that uses the clever effects. So.
I dig it.
I want to hit you with a shovel.
Carried by a knight?
But yeah.
Good night, folks.
Good night, turn bad night. Good night for you. But yeah. Other than that, I don't know. There's been a lot of news.
Not really.
It's not the type we tend to cover. But yeah, That's kind of the big stuff, the big ticket stuff so far. We want to try to keep this one relatively on the shorter side, but I'll mention that I popped in Shin Megami Tensei 5. I'm making progress in that. It's fun. Sometimes that's what you're in the mood for.
Yeah,
For those,
I need to get to that one at some point.
yeah, for those curious, I am playing Vengeance, but I am playing the Canon of Creation, aka the original Shin Megami Tensei 5 plot. I want to try that before I see what they did to remix it with the Canon of Vengeance. So that's where we are. And you wield one.
I played some Ninja Gaiden Ragebound.
Oh, that game's super cool.
Yeah. Funny story about that game. So
Yeah.
they announced that game.
Yeah.
I saw pictures of it and read
Yeah.
literally nothing about it and assumed it was a Metroidvania until close to release.
Nope. You get some abilities as you play through the game, but it's very linear.
Yeah, no, I have no complaints about that. Like, I really enjoy like a modern version of that type of game. But it's just funny because I was just like, oh, they made two Blasphemous games.
They Blasphemous, and those are both Metroidvania,
Yeah,
so this
everyone
must be.
loved The Messenger, which is basically, which is already Metroidvania Ninja Gaiden. So yeah, of course it's going to be one. Nope.
No, they're really well designed linear levels. I really
Yeah.
like the bouncing off of projectiles mechanic.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the well, the first boss that you have to fight twice.
Yeah.
Not really a spoiler. But
Yeah.
the boss fight, it was really cool. Like the super cool animations and
Oh yeah, the sprite
cool
work's
patterns to
gorgeous.
learn. It's really good. I look forward to playing more with it. I haven't I did like I did the first level with the second character.
Yeah,
So
that's that's a big change.
yeah, so
But
it seems super cool, and that's getting me more excited for Ninja Gaiden 4, which I've barely
yeah,
looked at.
do you know how deranged the Ninja Gaiden canon is?
I assumed very extremely deranged.
The Game Boy game is the first thing in the canon.
That's okay.
Ninja Gaiden Shadow.
Is there any
That's the first 3D.
easy way, any easy place to go play like the original NES games?
I think some of them might be on Switch Online. I can't remember. If not, then the answer is no, actually.
Yeah, that's sad.
Unless they're still being included in the Master Collection, because like the original Xbox version of Ninja Gaiden and Ninja Gaiden Black had the NES games hidden away in them. I don't know if they still had them in the Sigma ports that the Master Collection version is based off of.
I have to look
But if
into that.
so, then that, well, quote unquote easy. You would still have to play, like, to unlock them, you had to get very far into the 3D games to
Okay.
unlock them. So, I'm not actually clear on that.
So I think
If
you
you
told.
have a.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
I was gonna say, I think you told me Ragebound is like before the 3D games. Is that what you told
No, it
me?
is after the 3D
It's
games.
after the 3D
The 3D
games.
games
Okay.
are the 3D games are earlier than the NES games. Ragebound is taking place concurrent with the first NES game.
Okay. And when
So
year
if
is
you
four
have,
gonna fall?
I don't think we know actually.
Okay.
It might be post DOA games, which are the latest thing in the timeline.
Okay. Because I was playing through the game and Ryu is go like fucks off to America. I'm like, is this like during Ninja Gaiden 3? Does he go to America? I don't know if he actually goes to America in that one. That's just my vague recollection because I remember it involving soldiers.
I mean, the NES games are 1, 3, 2, but yeah, no, it's concurrent with 1.
Okay.
But I will point out, if you have a TurboGrafx 16 Mini, it has the very bad TurboGrafx port of Ninja Gaiden 1. That is a game with reverse parallax scrolling. Like, they fucked it up real bad. So, like, it looks like the opening city level looks like the entire city is fucking Kandor. You're in a cylinder. Yeah, deep cut nerd shit. Fuck you. But yeah. Otherwise, let me see if the. But you also. You also can't play the DS game, which takes place between the two 3D games.
Oh, God.
That game's actually really good.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw a copy of it years ago for pretty cheap, and I didn't grab it. No, I'm kicking myself because I'm pretty sure it's gone up in price. I'm afraid to look.
I'm sure it has. It's nearly 20 years old now. Yeah, that's Ninja Gaiden.
Ninja Gaiden's cool. Hopefully that Shinobi game is also... Is that one a Metroidvania? Please tell me. I haven't...
I don't know. Shinobi Art of Vengeance. That made him angry. Well, nothing says anything about it being...
Okay. I think my brain just wants me to play the Messenger. I think that's the takeaway.
I tried playing it, and it didn't really hook me, but maybe I'll like it better.
Maybe.
I just want to see the return of the time when we would just have ninjas named Joe showing up a lot. Shinobi had Joe Musashi, and Ninja Gaiden had Joe Hayabusa. Ryu's dad.
It's weird.
So, you know, like, why not? Bring back ninjas named Joe. Headache.
Fire miner. But yeah.
I have fires miner.
I gotta check my stream. I think Joe is posting in there. And I just said buy UFO 50 now.
He's a man who gets it. It's $25. That is 50 cents a game.
Yeah, maybe I'll give it a try. I do have a lot much easier time playing like fake retro games than I do going back and playing like some old retro games. I found.
Yeah, these are very clearly like inspired by old retro games, while having a lot of, you know, clearly having designs that you wouldn't have seen at the time. Okay. So it's the veneer and the fun faux history, while having, and a lot of them actually have a lot of nuance and substance to them. They don't feel like tiny mini games.
Yeah, that's cool.
So
I did enjoy, yeah, very recommend the retro game challenge.
Fires Miner says, Sega arcade games and Yakuza were the best examples of all games turned into unlockable bonuses in new games. Which one's the worst example, and was it Problem with Bad Emulator? Almost assuredly, if I were to hazard a guess, I would probably, like, just off the top of my head, I would say Final Fight Streetwise on the PS2. Because that game is just absolute unvarnished dog shit. And it has a version of Final Fight that runs at, like, a third speed.
Oh, God.
Like, it runs terribly. So you got a bad version of a great game inside of a terrible new game.
Great.
And Capcom made a good version of Final Fight on PS2 that emulated fine. It was on the Capcom Classics Collection. I don't know what happened. But yeah, just very, very bad. Very, very bad. There's some other ones. I'm trying to think of, like, because eventually this kind of thing sort of went away just because it was, you know, it was clear that you could just sell people an old game for a few bucks, and that made more sense than, like, just sneaking it into some sort of remake. But yeah, typically the answer for why these end up bad is that the emulator they wrote just doesn't quite work. Maybe the hardware's not up to it. But yeah, you end up with a version that is materially worse than if you just played a normal damn video game. The Mario All-Stars originally came out. Did people notice how strange its physics felt compared to the original? I've not seen any contemporary, like, I certainly didn't notice. I've not seen any contemporary reviews that said, hey, this game's physics are fucked up. I'm sure some people noticed it, but it was not the overwhelming discourse around that version at the time.
I think it was like, those games really
had, it was been, novel.
Yeah. It was, like, it's not something you can really remake a video game about. Yeah.
You know, the physics are kind of weird. They don't make the game unplayable. I'm glad that both versions tend to be available now. But it was also just like, you know, especially in the US, it was like, oh, and there's this other Mario game that's just complete asshole. So, you know, it was kind of
Mario 2 we missed. I wish it had stayed missed.
I think I will go put it in the desert.
Yeah.
Have you tried the Final Fight port on BBA? I have not. Final Fight 1 is really weird, though, because it's technically like it's using the Super Nintendo version as a basis. They hacked in 2-player, and it has, like, weird alternate characters, like Street Fighter Alpha versions of the characters. It's weird. Final Fight 1 is a weird version. Capcom has a bunch of, like, weird ports on GBA. I really like Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo Revival, which you would think would just be Super Turbo, and it's full of very strange changes. Like, Ryu's stage gets cut and replaced with a weird fucked up version of his third strike stage. Chun's stage is also cut and replaced with a weird fucked up version of her Alpha 2 stage. The final stage has been cut, and it's now like an interior, like, weird hell dungeon inside of Shadaloo. Like, a lot of the background stages have been cut. All the character, like, portrait art for the character select screen was completely changed. It's a very strange version. Guile's stage has also been completely redone. I think it might be based off of, like, Charlie's and Alpha, but I don't know. Yeah, Turbo Revival is a really, really, really weird version. And then you had, like, Alpha 3 Upper on GBA, which had, like, a whole bunch of additional characters and was, like, extremely impressive work from its developer, Crawfish Interactive, but ended up coming out late and kind of bankrupting them. But that's a really weird, impressive version. Which reminds me, Capcom made, like, this truly bizarre update to the Fighting Collection 2. Did you see this?
No.
So they patched the version of Alpha 3 Upper in there to include all the new characters from Double Upper, the PSP version. Like, so it has Maki, Yun, Eagle, like, I think all of those were ripped from their CVS2 versions, and Ingrid from Capcom Fighting Evolution.
Okay.
Like, it was a very strange thing that they just suddenly patched in a bunch of additional characters. They just added a whole bunch of, like, little things, and it's just like, why? What? Why? It's kind of neat because, like, again, those characters were not available in a lot of places. I think they also added there's some weird shit. There's some really obscure modes in Alpha 3 that had is that were very hard to actually unlock. That do strange things. Like, you would have to, I forget what the exact requirements were, but like the arcade machine had to have been played for a certain number of hours, and like certain conditions had to have been met, and then you would put in a button combination that would activate things like Psycho Mode, just some really weird, silly, Mozzie, Psycho, and Classic modes. Mozzie mode, you could set one player to, and they would deal a lot more damage and take a lot more damage and lose if their opponents lost, if they lost a round. With Psycho mode, which is referencing Dan, you're much easier to stun. And in Classic mode, it tries to make the game more like Street Fighter 2. So no more super combos, no more air guard, and like recovering from a throw. They're all gone. So just really strange. Like, it was interesting to see them patch that in, because those were very obscure versions and features to be patched into Alpha 3 Upper. So it's nice to just see that as an option. So that was really cool. I liked that. Sadly, still no World Tour mode. Bring that back. If I remember, so someone recently posted on Twitter a video of Hulk Hogan and a bunch of WWF wrestlers in an infomercial about an unlicensed NES games. I know that Nintendo would have never allowed retailers to carry unlicensed games, but I've had no idea that you have. But I've no idea that you've had to order those things by mail. Yeah, I mean, like, it's one of those things, like, unlicensed games found places to be sold where, like, the only thing Nintendo could do to a company that sold unlicensed games was say, you can't sell licensed ones. But if you have no intention of selling licensed games, that's not a punishment. Like, it's the same reason that, like, Color Dreams turned into Wisdom Tree and started selling nothing but Christian games. Like, that was a canny business move to put their games in stores that wouldn't carry normal games anyway. Wisdom Tree games were sold in like Christian bookstores, because a Christian bookstore being told by Nintendo, well, you can't sell licensed games. Like, we weren't selling licensed games to begin with. I wasn't gonna sell you Zelda. That's devil shit in that. So, you know, it's like, whatever. They'll sell you Spiritual Warfare or fucking Bible Adventures or whatever. Meanwhile, if you it's the same thought. Like, you know, if you're doing a mail order business, it's like your mail order business wasn't selling anything else anyway. Here's a bunch of unlicensed games that are getting hawked by Hulk Hogan. Like, Hulk Hogan does not give a fuck about it, never gave a fuck about what he was promoting.
Nope.
You ever hear about the Hulk Hogan Ultimate Grill?
No, that sounds terrible.
It was very bad. I believe there was some sort of I the he like it was presumably an attempt to get in competition with the George Foreman grill, which Hulk Hogan routinely lied and claimed that he had fucking passed on an offer to endorse. There's absolutely no evidence of that. But there was the Hulk Hogan Ultimate Grill, which I believe was some sort of like fire hazard. I think there was some sort of like problem that forced that to be recalled. The Alpha 3 Upper update also includes a bunch of weird isms from the... Yeah, that's the Psycho, Mozzie, and Classic modes. Old school Alpha 3 and MVC 2 players like to talk about how they had to leave their Dreamcast on the whole night and put tapes on the controllers to unlock some things in those games. Yeah, they were... If you're a sufficiently similar enough arcade port, you get those weird things where it's like, well, they didn't really change the conditions to make these things available, so you get some really stupid ways that you have to unlock things. Have geolocation-based games reached an evolutionary dead end? While I still see ads on Japanese TV for Dragon Quest Walk and Monster Hunter Now, it seems to me like these games make sense as data generator for other companies instead of profit makers themselves. I think it's fully become a case of, like, you need to have something big to attach to them. There's not really a, like, you know, Pokemon Go, like, nearly 10 years ago now, came out and did huge numbers. And then I've never been clear on how well that was ultimately monetized to begin with, because I didn't play it because a multitude of reasons. But I've not gotten the impression that there's like a lot of growth in that sector. If you're a very large franchise that has a lot of name recognition, you can get someone to put that app on their phone and then play some mildly diverting mini game involving your IP. But if not, like, why would I do that with something I've never heard of for horrible little bastards that I have no desire to interact with? Like, I don't think that there's much growth in that sector as an outside observer. Seeing a lot more people using services that are basically interactive audiobooks, which make you change your walking regimen to proceed. There's one for Marvel and one for Lord of the Rings. Yeah, I like, this is one of those situations where, like, I could talk out my ass about how I haven't heard about them, but I'm also, my finger is not on the pulse of that market, and I don't think Wheels is either. Nope. Okay. 2 years ago, I asked about franchises like Sonic and Toho that had grown bigger than the game. Now that Umamusume has released in the West and seems like a hit, I can see one thing in common with this type of franchise. People might not necessarily like the gameplay of Uma, Toho, or Fate. There's still a lot in the characters for outsiders to explore, be it from reading actual history like Uma and Fate, or Dojinshi like Toho. Yeah, I mean, like, I think ultimately a lot of these are, like, a bunch of, like, a lot of fans, I wouldn't say most, but certainly a significant portion of fandom for any of these is people that, like, their interaction with the quote-unquote core product, like, their investment with the core product is limited compared to their love of, like, a very specific aspect of it. Frequently, like, character, mostly the character designs, and then that carries them into things that keep them hooked in. So, like, you know, a lot of these, they might have, you know, kind of limited gameplay, or, like, be kind of abusively monetized, or they might have niche genres in the case of, like, Toho. Like, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, Toho, I feel like a lot of the appeal for those games is, like, it's ripping off other games.
Like, those are for the non-official games. I'm talking about, like, the core games.
Okay.
Yeah, because, like, the core games of Toho are primarily bullet hell shooters, and, like, those certainly have a dedicated fan base, but, you know, that is not enough to be anywhere close to sustaining what is here. Everything that you play on Steam at this point, or, like, the Switch at this point, like, that's technically, like, a fan game. I don't know how licensing works with Toho. There's some sort of very permissive license, but it's not created by the original creator, who does still make things.
Yeah.
I'm
gonna be honest, it's a series I've bought a lot of games from, because they're copying other games, and I know very little about the franchise.
One of them is Mario Kart Double Dash. One of them's FF12. I don't understand.
One of them is Double Dash?
Yeah, there's a Double Dash one.
Oh, God.
But yeah, like, it's one of those things, like, Toho is a complete enigma. The appeal of Toho as an aesthetic is a complete enigma to me. All of these are just replacement level anime scrungos to me.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that, like, it, evidently it taps into something.
I guess. I mean, for me, it's like you replace those characters with, I don't know, whatever the fuck else. I wouldn't care.
Yeah, you wouldn't, but, like, evidently for a lot of people, these are very specifically their favorites. They are mad when they get portrayed one way or another, which is a hard... which is a hard place to be in. A lot of these characters don't actually have a lot of quote-unquote canonical portrayals. You know, a lot of them might only have, like, a couple of lines in a handful of games, and but people have very strong feelings about them, and probably in part because a lot of them just don't have a lot of hard canon saying what they are. For a lot of people, you know, they might never... write fiction in a way that they would consider to be writing, but a lot of people will interact with kind of these outlines of characters by projecting tons of different things onto them, and that produces just some weird just some very specific kinds of responses. I'm saying this isn't something you can easily do. Just look at how many failed gacha games are based on personifications of warships, aircraft, guns, etc. Yeah, I mean, there's a million of these, and you really do need to successfully get someone. You really do need to have, like, something that catches the eye of a large portion of a large group of people. I don't know what that is. I will see these. And, like, I'll look at, say, the new round of Horse Girls, and I'll just be like, these seem extremely like all the other things I could be getting in a gacha game of some abusive variety, but some people are into it. I don't get it. But it's one of those things, like, just because I don't get it, I can't pretend that it's not a phenomenon, that there isn't something there. I just have to accept that I don't understand it. Speaking of gacha games, there's an arms race going on with skins in gacha games. Live 2D is the old thing now. Now it's an immersive experience with games like Snowbreak you made that one up. allowing you to play touchy-feely with your wife who's in sandbox environments that are Azure Lane, incorporating hidden mini-games in the skins. On the other hand, Girl Frontline has just introduced a pretty predatory skin gacha system. I mean, they... given enough time, the odds of a predatory skin system being introduced become one. That is just how these are built. But I would feel so much more frustrated by these, personally, if there was, like, entire game modes I could only access if I got skins that were gacha. Like, I couldn't even choose to get them. Like, it was just like, oh, you rolled the dice and you got the skin that has, like, a whole other mode or feature hidden behind it. That would make me tear my hair out. Don't get me started on the proliferation of string bikinis and other types of impossible clothing that are just one step above nudity. I mean, that's been there since the inception of this entire concept. Like, there is an eternal arms race for how much skin your characters can be showing before the App Store tells them to get lost. Unity recently received a feature that allows deliberate low-poly count and texture warping to replicate PS1 graphics. Former FF10 and Xenogears programmers then commented that everyone back then were forced to work around the PS1's limitations and it was a pain in the ass. I didn't get why people felt nostalgic about it. Putting aside this question, has there ever been a game so ugly, both technically and aesthetically, that it became memorable? I'd say there's, like, a handful of those for me, like, in that early PS1 era. Go look up Cosmic Race. That game's absolutely goddamn hideous. Go look up Rondo for Saturn. That's an SMT strategy RPG spinoff that looks... so bad. Like, so bad. You would not assume it to be a professional product. Like, I mean, like if we if it has to be both technically and aesthetically, like we are limited to some of these early games, but you know, there's definitely some other stuff where it's like a game just becomes like memorably hideous. But yeah, I would argue, like, to connect to that particular developer's insights, I will say personally that while I enjoy it, like, what kinds of early of retro jank you enjoy is very in the eye of the beholder. Like, I personally enjoy low poly and low res texture aesthetics. I have no love in my heart for the PS1's like horrible texture warping, and would like shut that off in a heartbeat if it were up to me. Let's see. Fireman brings up Ecstatica looked kind of crude when it came to the use of color and shadow, but its surreal look fits a British black comedy. Ecstatica is a weird fucking game.
I don't know what that is.
It is a like DOS kind of, I don't even know how to describe what it's going for. Wikipedia chooses to say survival horror, and I suppose that's close enough. But as I recall, it's primarily made of ellipsoids. Yeah, so everything is made of like oblong, like oblong spherical polygons. Like that's what the characters are made of, up of like oval, like weird oblong spheres and ovals and shit. And it's super weird looking, and that does indeed make it pretty memorable. It's a very strange game. Definitely can see why there weren't a lot of follow-ons from that one, but I mean, it's memorable. I would never pretend that when you've seen Ecstatica, you will remember Ecstatica. Let's see. I asked last year about why there aren't any colorful Souls-like. You said Souls-like gameplay and atmosphere wouldn't fit a colorful and whimsical setting. And whimsical setting. It makes me want to ask, though, why there aren't that many lifelike comedic video games. What if I just want a game that looks just as real as a sitcom set? Is it budget and manpower, or is it an artistic problem? Because if you're making a game that looks so real, you'd be limited to which type of comedy you can do. I mean, to start with, there just aren't a lot of like comedy games to begin with. Like, that is just not...
It's hard to do.
It's not the primary thought process. If you go full realism with your comedy, like say you're one of the vanishingly rare like pure comedy games, or like not even pure comedy games, but primarily a comedy game. Like the gameplay is okay. So I'm gonna look at this from another perspective. A realistic video game that is primarily about comedy. What is the play angle of that game? What is the mechanical identity of such a game? I feel like it kind of ends up having to be something that is almost entirely dialogue. Because like when you make something super realistic that is primarily meant to be funny, like dialogue ends up being what such a thing would probably have to lean on. I'm trying to think of what other mode of game it could be, because if you're doing like slapstick, you probably want something that can emphasize the comedic, like, you know, you end up with something cartoony for the nature of the squash and stretch aesthetic Like, it defangs the violence inherent to slapstick comedy and emphasizes what's funny about it. Like, you can get a weirder, funnier response out of that. So we kind of end up having to be a dialogue-based game. So we're spending a lot, relatively speaking, a lot of art budget on realistic character designs for a game that has not at all mass market gameplay and an assumption of that is, you know, ultimately going to be very heavily reliant on dialogue, pacing, and performance. It just, I think ultimately you would find that it would be very hard to do, and it would be considered a very strange fit for the medium. I don't think it's impossible, but I can't really imagine in my mind what it looks like. I can't fit together how to make that entire, to square that circle. I think one of the things that is also necessary to contextualize is that a situational comedy in a game will probably involve, like, you know, game comedy will usually involve mechanics, and that would usually, like, if you wanted to do comedy, like, mechanical subversion would show up a lot. Like, you know, there's the classic prank at the start of I Want to Be the Guy. So you walk under a tree. you walk under a tree, and the cherry on it falls and smashes you. So that's funny, but it's like, that's okay. Don't trust them. Jump over them this time. You jump over the next one, and it falls up and hits you. That's an extreme. That is a mechanical subversion. That is gameplay as comedy.
I hate and love that game so much.
Yeah. But it's a really I think that kind of paints a picture of, like, between these two things, we run into the issues here. If we're looking for an extremely realistic world with characters that are doing relatively realistic, banal things like a sitcom, the more gamey the game becomes, the more surrealist any attempt to force, like, say, adventure game gameplay in becomes. Like, you get very strange, like, if I'm playing a game that's essentially, like, to throw one out there, an episode of The Office, and I'm having to, like, combine items like Monkey Island, that's going to feel insane. And you kind of have to turn that into the joke at that stage. But, you know, that obviously broadly kind of pigeonholes you into surrealist humor. Very day-to-day life humor, it's very hard to determine how that fits into a game mechanically. Without, I guess, the majority of the game becomes decision trees and dialogue checks. That feels like what that game would inevitably become. And if you're spending the money on realistic graphics, you're like, that's probably kind of a hard sell to make a game that's primarily decisions and dialogue and very little action or twitch moment-to-moment mechanical interaction. Brings up, there's a reason why the Stanley Parable fans just won't stop asking for a sequel. Yeah, that's an interesting another one that sort of takes that concept and sort of starts from the, like, you know, it ends up being video game absurdism in a lot of ways. Like, a game with a bazillion different endings that sort of depend on you sort of taking strange routes and detours, and sort of like the absurdity of the choices you're making and the narration and dialogue are really what ends up carrying that in comedic terms. But yeah, I think that like something more, anything more down to earth than the Stanley Parable ends up with a lot of problems it has to solve. And I don't know that I've ever seen a game completely solve them without dipping into, you know, accepting that the answers to these problems are going to be by getting less realistic. You previously talked about the Eidolons taking center stage in the story of modern FF games. What do you think about replacing the Eidolons with weapons in this case? In other words, why are super bosses in RPGs usually not that connected to the main story? Is it because they're secrets you've got to go out of your way to do because you want people to finish the main story, and putting a super boss there is like putting a boulder on the path? It's really down to, like, if it's just in the normal game, it's not a super boss. That's just kind of it. It sort of ceases to be that. If it's still absurdly hard, it's a difficulty spike, and people complain about it for different reasons. But like the definition that most people have of super bosses would necessarily preclude anything that you were forced to fight. You can maybe get away with it if it's a fight that you can win, but don't have to. Like, that is probably as close as you can get to a forced super boss encounter. But broadly speaking, those don't have... If you have to fight them, I think most people, in the colloquial sense, would not consider them a super boss. And again, if you do put that in the path, and it's not the... Like, it's not the climax, you've kind of undercut the ability of the climax to be interesting in a mechanical sense. So you've got a lot of... It creates a lot of problems. Honestly, like, weapons... I think I wouldn't really want to see weapons show up in games that aren't 7, because they're really specific to 7's world. And I wouldn't want someone to just like, oh, we're just going to do that again. Like, you could do other, like, kaiju kinds of creatures, certainly. I think, and, you know, like, certainly those show up as well. I think my issue, like, certainly there's, most Final Fantasy games have, since, like, 6 on, have had some major use for summon creatures. 7 actually has them as the least explained among them, but like guardian forces are important in 8, even if they're not well considered. Eidolons in 9 are very important to the world as a whole, like they're used to wage war. 10 obviously hugely important. I don't know anything about 11's story. 12, they're kind of like... And here's the point I would make. I'm not against the summon beast being a part of the plot. I'm tired of them being the cause. Like, I'm tired of them being kind of the reason everything is happening. Like, they can reasonably augment the plot. Like, oh, this, you know, especially, this is in part because it's also conflating with, like, a lot of recent FF games have been about the gods did this, and oftentimes, as a identifying touch point, the gods are also the summon creatures. But, you know, they aren't always the same, but, like, 13, the gods did this, 15, the gods did this, 16... like ultimately caused by what essentially amounts to God. Like, I would rather that it be caused by a person or organization than the gods. Like, you even go back to, like, some things that are kind of nebulously one way or the other. Like, Xdeath's a huge piece of shit, and, like, a bazillion wizards trapped in a tree. Still basically a dude, just a really strong dude. Zeromus, like, kind of a horrible demon thing. But not the gods, not the, I'm being nitpicky, there are fine distinctions here. I'm tired of the gods did this, and that's why we have to deal with it. I want to be to fight a guy who sucks and is a huge asshole, Kefka. Or an organization.
Huh? Kefka.
Sure, fine. Or like a guy who sucks.
The douchebag from Final Fantasy XV, whose name I always forget.
Yeah, like, you know, like, there's a bunch of these, but, you know, I just want them to take less center stage. Yeah. I'm, like, they can, yeah, I would prefer that they be treated sort of like Nine does, where they're sort of like, their power that's fought over, and they do have wills, but that will is not really being imposed on the world that much. In general, that's what I'm hoping for, is that they can recede back into being one of many things that is being used as proxy for the kinds of conflicts that are more interesting to me, that involve, like, people and, you know, ideals and character drama. I don't know. I'm just kind of tired of... Kind of tired of gods doing things.
I mean, I probably wouldn't have said the same thing before playing 16. But now I'm there.
Let's see. Has anyone in RP Game ever tried to do a tier list for FF Super Bosses? Look, like, at this point, the Iron Giant just doesn't feel like a super boss anymore. I mean, that it doesn't help that they routinely just put that in as a normal-ass enemy. Even Omega isn't as overexposed as the Iron Giant. On the other hand, we don't get to fight Shinryu too often, right? I'd have to think about it. Shinryu is definitely a pretty, like, rare one to show up, relatively speaking. Omega shows up plenty. Iron Giant, like, just turned into a regular part of the bestiary. Like, that was demoted to normal enemy. But yeah, Shinryu of the recurring super bosses is probably the least the least prone to returning. Plenty of games have their own one-off ones that have never shown up before and will likely never show up again, like Ozma or Yasmat. You have honestly the one who shows up the most at this point. Almost feels like Gilgamesh. Like, he's a required fight in 5, but basically every other time he shows up where you fight him, he's kind of like a hidden super boss. And he's not the hardest, but he definitely shows up a lot. To the point where, like, when he showed up in 15 and was, like, just a completely different dude, people got pissed.
He's got his own magic card.
Yep, very different Gilgamesh. Like, presumably just a different dude who happens to also be named Gilgamesh, but yeah, just one of those things where, like, I say that's a mark of something, is that, like, people saw a Gilgamesh who was not the Gilgamesh, and they were like, what the fuck? What did you do? There's none of these that I'm like, oh, I'm sick of seeing these. I don't want to see the super boss again. Because if I don't want to fight a super boss, I just don't fight it. But yeah, like, I would honestly say that Gilgamesh is, like, pushing up to being one of the most frequent ones. With his return in, like, the 7 Remake trilogy. Back when Square Enix still made the international versions for Final Fantasy games, did anyone here import the original Japanese release? Including OGF of 12, how different do they feel compared to their updated versions? I did not have the kind of money necessary to be importing back when those were relevant, even though I looked with awe at some of like KH2 International and FF10 International, although that one was kind of bullet dodged. I don't think any of the changes made in FF10 International are good. To think of other ones. Like, we think of this as like this really big thing. This didn't actually last too terribly long. Like, it was done by the end of the PS2 era. And in the PS1 era, they just weren't as changed. Like, you get like FF7 International. What is that? It adds the additional weapon fights that we had in the US version. That's as far as I can, and a couple of additional boss fights that were just dropped into the US version. Like, that's it. There's not actually that much. It's like, it's on the PS2 where they start getting ambitious with them. That's also when a lot of them get kind of frustrating, because they really do have heavy changes to them. Like, obviously, like 10 Internationals got the expert grid and the awful, awful, awful Dark Aeons and Penance fights. You've got like 10-2 International plus Last Mission has its moments, because it's got like the additional jobs, which is kind of neat. KH2 International plus Rechain of Memories. Well, we got the Rechain of Memories, but KH2 International has a bunch of cool additional boss fights that are kind of neat to have.
Did not like but Rechain of Memories at all.
It's not a great version.
No.
I'm trying to think of other ones. There's Dirge of Cerberus International. I don't think anyone cared about that.
The only one I ever played like that was 12 International when they did. There was someone put out an English
Zodiac Job System. Yeah.
No, it was before that. Someone.
Yeah, I said Zodiac Job System, not Zodiac Age.
Yeah.
I've complained about that version enough. Like, it just bothers me that you can't play the game as it was originally released. Like, give me access to the original grid. Like, you can, and I have seen people argue, but it's worse. And it's like, I don't care. I want to play the game you fucking released. Like, it should still be possible to play the game you made. But yeah, I've never imported the original Japanese releases. I've looked deep into what some of the changes were in some of those, like, pre-international releases. A lot of them, they're pretty minor. Like, they're polished up a little bit in international releases, and then they do kind of like a much like the international versions on PS2. Part of the reason I think they stopped doing these is that they were spending all of this time making new content, and there was no plausible justification to release it anywhere but Japan. Like, it just didn't make any sense to keep doing this, especially when you could just start selling DLC if you really wanted to keep making changes. So I think that's probably why they sort of stopped doing that. But I've never personally played, like, Japanese original release FF10, Japanese original release KH1 and 2, Japanese original release FF12. That's just beyond my count. I could not afford them at the time. What about FF? I assume that's supposed to be FF12's license board. What did it lead to people making four identical characters in their parties? Was it because they were too many options? Lazy people just resorted to min-maxing and looking up online guides? It's a very open system. People tend to look for guidance with very open systems. I've thought about this a lot, because, like, one of the ways that that developers tend to disincentivize bad decisions is making them unfun to do. But if a bad decision will lead to a lot of mechanical power, people and grinding is oftentimes that bad decision. Like, you can grind your way to a lot of mechanical power in that original license board. And I guess they wanted to disincentivize that more heavily because people were complaining. But also, like, yeah, I don't know. I liked it when I could decide how similar or different I wanted two characters to be without having to lock them into being exactly the same. I don't like that. That I don't have the option to play the game as they made it. But yeah, I think it's, I wouldn't say lazy, but I do think it is like a player that doesn't have a lot of confidence in making builds will probably end up looking for guidance in open systems. I would consider it the same as like, here's one for Wheels. I would consider it similar to people net decking.
Yeah, that's what like I you, do.
Yeah, like you know, there's, because you know, with a card deck, there's a lot of things you could potentially put in there, and it can be really hard to consider all of their potential interactions. So mm-hmm. you look up someone that knows how to use them, and they say, "Well, these cards work well together," and it's like, "Well, that's what I'll do."
I mean, yeah, that's what I do not have the time to do that in Hearthstone, so I have to net deck if I want to.
It's success. One of the things. Some people love building that perfect, you know, like theorizing that perfect build.
Yeah,
I mean, and the actual building of it is almost secondary, or the use of it, I should say, is almost secondary.
Yeah.
Some people get the most out of when a build is synergizing correctly, and the actual providence of where that build came from is secondary concern.
I think I love doing that for Commander, but I mean that is a much longer process to try and figure out, because you may put in a few new cards and not draw them in your 100 card deck for like 5 games.
It is hard to tell whether that was whether those would have been effective or not. But yeah, I think that there's like a lot to be said for just these kinds of things, just ending up being kind of, how do I put this? Like, I think that different people are going to end up liking these things for different reasons. And so, like, the other thing I would say is that if the idea was to prevent people from, like, looking up a build, that manifestly didn't work. because I don't even think it was the intention, because, like, the way that the game was originally designed in that original International Zodiac Chop System version was that you had 12 jobs and 6 characters and no option to respec.
Ugh.
And, you know, each character could only have one job. Like, at this point with Zodiac Age, every character can have 2 jobs and you can respec at any time. Which is, you know, eliminating all of those concerns. But, like, in the original release, you were obligately locked out of at least half of the job boards. And there was simply no two ways about it. Whereas, like, it's one of those things, like, if the desire was to keep people from looking up what to do, that would not be a logical way to go about doing it, because you were making it clear that the choice you have could go very wrong if you just decide, I'm going to have an archer. Oh, it turns out archers aren't very good. that's the original International Zodiac Job System for you. Also, hello.
Oh.
Hey, Joe.
I was listening in, but I had stuff to do before I could jump on.
Let's see. Firewriter is saying Wheels is thinking of, yeah, when you brought up you didn't remember the guy from 15's name, you were thinking of Arden, as Firewriter brings up.
Yeah.
All in all, not the worst antagonist, though Arden made me notice that we probably wouldn't see a pathetic FF antagonist on the level of Cypher. Yeah, Cypher's kind of a weird guy, just because, like, he's kind of the rival, but, like, he's just sort of bad by the end of the first disc, and only gets sadder over time. And yeah, that's a dynamic we don't see that often. I wouldn't mind them revisiting this idea of like someone who's just genuinely, like pitiable, like not sympathetic but pitiable. Because that's definitely how I would describe Cypher, like just someone who, like, in his own way, is just a complete arrested development case. Elements of Before Crisis have already been incorporated into FF7 Remake, but will we get to fight Jade Weapon? I can't imagine that being high enough on the priorities list to find its way in, but I'd be into it. I'm dumb. Jade Weapon is a very silly looking thing. Like, if you don't know Jade Weapon, because again, it really did only show up in Before Crisis, it's sort of like a bat meets a fighter jet. I think it's probably supposed to be a ray of some sort, but it's a really funky looking thing that's kind of neat. I wouldn't mind if we could go toe to toe with all of the different weapons that have shown up in various materials in FF7 Remake Part 3, but I guess we will see. How many years before someone at Square Enix finally put the Dress Sphere / Schema system in a new Japanese RPG, be it FF or not? Am I the only one who thinks having class change in the middle of the battle might seem to be overwhelming to the casual player, and it seems a bit expensive to make all those outfits that could have been turned into DLC? So what I'll say first of all is that what you're asking for seems to be the next time that Motomu Toriyama is put at the helm of something and just allowed to go nuts. Because 10-2 and 13 are both his, and they are the relevant points of comparison here. I mean, he's one of the several co-directors on FF7 Remake, so presumably sometime after that wraps, we might see him get given something else to continue iterating on those concepts with. That's what I would suspect. As for changing classes in mid-battle being a little complex, I think that the way FF13's combat system is structured is them admitting that that's the case. Like, 13 is kind of all about you being in the right set of like the right set of classes, and then what those classes do is largely automated. It's just a function of what the classes are built to do. I think 13's entire setup is built to try to make that simple enough to be palatable to the mainstream. Difficult to say how well it worked, given 13's controversial status, but a lot of 13's controversial status is among hardcore grognards, so who can say?
Yeah, but it is a lot of grognards. I like that word.
What's that?
I like the word grognards. Enjoy that.
Gotcha. But broadly speaking, it is kind of wasteful if you have to make a new outfit for everyone. There's a reason they don't like doing that anymore if they can help it. But you see it show up on occasion. It does sort of, I think when you do something like that, it does mean that more and more of your resources are being devoted to combat. You end up making a more combat focused game just because of how many resources you're having to do to fill out the aesthetic and mechanical depth of that system. Let's see. And then Fireminer says, Cypher's closest analog is Jared Mesa from Zeta Gundam. I see where you're getting that. Both started as a rival to the protagonist before devolving into extremely pitiable whipping boys. Yeah, that's a fair cop. I would be shocked if they weren't at least thinking about that. Zeta Gundam was extraordinarily popular in Japan. If you get a choice between a submarine or a train, which one would you take?
Train.
In other words, how many times has a Japanese RPG got underwater exploration right? I think that answer is close to, if not zero. I like going around the spooky underwater section of FF7, but it is not compelling outside of the aesthetic value. There's not a lot under there, and especially in the American version, where you might just randomly run into a super boss that you are not at all prepared for. Not ideal. Not ideal. But, you know, they also aren't meant to do that much. They're mostly just, like, to give the sense of really seeing everything there is in the world. I mean, it's the same reason that you go to the moon in FF4. It's not because the moon is going to be it's going to be a huge mechanical shakeup. It's just to give the sense that you're seeing everything going everywhere. Like, it gives the sense of a big adventure. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of like trains. there's a sense of deliberacy to them that I appreciate. Should you give your player an airship or any other vehicle right from the start, or should you let them explore the overworld on foot for a bit first? Where does something like FF Metal Max give you a tank pretty soon, but you still have to work for a bit to get there? I mean, it's always going to depend on your design goals. You end up having to do weird gymnastics if you want a linear game that still gives you an immediate access to a controllable airship. Like, FF3, you get one almost immediately that you then crash into some mountains. And then later on you get one that can't go over mountains, and then you get one that can go over mountains, but it has to sort of, like, briefly raise and lower, like it's jumping over them. And I think that FF3 kind of deftly explains why a linear game typically does not give you immediate access to these. There's definitely some worth to it, but you do kind of have to. It is paradoxically constraining, just by dint of giving the user potentially a lot of movement. Like, Metal Max gives you a tank early on, but what tanks are for is very different from what airships are for in Final Fantasy. The tank in Metal Max is not just your... excuse me. The tank in Metal Max is not just your means of locomotion. It's also, like, primarily a combat conceit. Like... It doesn't give you the freedom of motion that an airship does. If you get an airship in Final Fantasy, you're flying over things. You're flying, like, the thing that can stop you is there's no place to land. And that's kind of like, that fundamental idea is very different and kind of presents the problem.
Do you think we will ever get to pilot a Magitek armor
or any other form of mecha in another FF? I'd never say never, but I wouldn't say it's a particularly high chance. I don't think that aesthetic is currently popular enough to find its way in as, like, a major as the core gimmick of a Final Fantasy game anytime soon. It might come back into popularity and resurge at some point, but right now I don't see it happening. I'm sorry we're kind of rushing through, but I need to start going to bed earlier, so this is going to be a slightly short cast. So I'm going to answer this last one, and then Joe's going to tell us a little bit about what he's been doing, and then we're going to finish out. I tend to actually been two games, one for Yuna and one for Riku, as was initially the plan slash rumor. How would they even look? Or even 10.3 if 13's development hadn't gotten in its way. I don't think it's 13 that got in the way of 10.3. I think it was some combination of 15 and 7 remake that got in the way of 10.3. But what I'll say about Yuna and Riku is that, like, I think part of the reason that those projects didn't end up happening is that it's probably kind of hard to justify, well, why wouldn't Yuna and Riku work together? Why would they be going their separate ways? What's Riku doing? Like, Yuna has an obvious thing to do because, like, she's defining herself after Tidus is gone. Like, is she... whether that's finding a way to bring him back or if it's, like, her just charting her own path, there's, like, a very obvious plot hook there that Riku kind of just doesn't have. Like, you could do something with, like, Riku trying to, you know, find her way in the world as, like, an albed in a world that has historically been very prejudiced and is likely to remain that way even without the theoretical quote-unquote source. But that's also a really grim game, and Riku is not a grim character. That idea doesn't have a lot of legs. I would imagine that, like, some of this, like, the whole idea of two of them, Yuna and Riku, as games probably just came from, well, how do we get the most use out of these assets in this popular game? And then ultimately, as they were, I don't think that Yuna and Riku as separate projects ever left paper. Like, I don't think that there was... I don't think that there was ever a point where, like, there was actually a team rounded up. I think that those projects in pre-production naturally merged when it became clear that they're just... The idea of splitting them into two just simply did not make sense. There's a lot of ways you can theoretically approach it, but all of them sort of force you to, like, scenaristically tie a hand behind your back to make any kind of sense. So I would say I don't think any real work was ever done on them as separate games. I think that there was potentially some discussion internally, like, certainly I think probably a little bit of pre-production was done as separate projects before it was decided that that the idea didn't make sense, they should just make a sequel to FF10. For 10.3, like I said, I think that like, if I were to hazard what, like, you run into other problems if you do this, like, what mechanical difference is there between a Yuna game and a Riku game? Are they sequels? Are they concurrent? There's just a lot of questions that I don't think anyone ever actually answered. It's one of those things, like, I think those games never, like, based on what little I've ever been able to hear about this, I don't think any real... like, I wouldn't describe those games as canceled if someone asked. And, like, there will always be, when something doesn't get made but is known to have been proposed, there will always be the question of, like, was it canceled? And I would say that it's more like it was never started. I think there were much more concrete ideas for what they thought 10.3 might be. I think that those ideas likely would have ended up with a plot that ultimately felt like kind of a retread of FF10-1. But I also ultimately think that what prevented them from doing that was simply that there were other projects that were too high of a priority, and I think that, like, we're getting on to the point where anyone who would be involved in such a game is quite old and, you know, probably only has two or three AAA games left in them before they're ready to retire. And, you know, at that stage, do you want one of them to be a direct sequel to a game from 25 years ago? Probably not. I think that you would, to make an FF10-3 at this stage, you'd probably have to start by remaking FF10-1 and 2. And that would take so long that if you wanted to include people who were originally involved, key, like, players on the FF10 team, I don't know that there would be time left in their career meaningfully, like, to reasonably assume that that could be possible. Just because of how long AAA games take to make. I don't think that'll ever happen. I think that there were probably relatively concrete ideas of what that game would be, again, because they made FF10 Will, they made FF10, they wrote FF10 Will, they wrote FF10 2.5, like, there was clearly some idea of what a third main FF10 game might look like, but I don't think that that game, I don't think that's a game that I personally, we've talked about it before, I don't think that's a game I personally would have wanted.
I mean, I might be interested, but at this point, I want a new Final Fantasy to wipe the FF16 taste out of my mouth.
Ready for, yeah, 17. Hopefully someone got assigned to 17 long before 16 came out, but given how they go about these things, I don't even know.
Hello,
we're just about to close out.
I literally just got home. Our return yesterday was slightly hindered by the fact that literally half of the island was under emergency situations due to rainfall over the past week. Like, buses, trains, highways, service discontinued. Okay, well, I shall tell you all about the vacation next week, I suppose.
Sounds good.
Okay. Okay, just wanted to say hi since I saw that you were actually still on. I figured, you know what, might as well see. Okay.
You can still plug your stuff.
Yeah, let's hear you.
I'm so jet-lagged at this point, I'm not sure, but I would like to say thank you to the kind person who has read over 2,000 pages of my stuff over the last week, 2 weeks.
Oh my god.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, I mean, every other month or so, I'll get somebody who has decided to just speed read through the entire Princesses series. And it's at about 2,600 pages right now.
It's nice.
It's very nice. Yep. So.
If you want to be like that brave hero, go to like Amazon.com. Kindle and Kindle Unlimited will get you and Dead Tree formats for Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, a book about playing tabletop games and the bad choices that come with them, but in a way that is less likely to make you regret knowing the people involved than any given actual play podcast.
I was going to say that's very true just because they're all fictional in this case. But also predates most actual play podcasts. When did the first one start?
That would be a hard
question.
Let's see. I started writing this in September 2015. So. So sometime back there. But anyway, absolutely no connection, even conceptually, no connection to an actual play podcast, because I did not know they existed until several years later.
Some of the same appeal, the joy of vicarious tabletop role-playing. with actual dice rolls influencing the plot.
Sometimes to my own regret. It's like, why did I give this character this item? Nice. Yeah.
Like a real DM. But,
I can tell you a few stories from this week, but I will save them for next week. So.
Yeah. But yeah, Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. You can also pick up some edification by Japanese folktales. Get yourself a little cultural education with Tsunuki as a teapot, which has many folktales, some of which have essentially no other extant English version. Can also...
Or at most one in a few cases, because one of my sources did get itself translated like 50 years ago. For scholarship purposes. So suffice to say that the telling is quite a bit different in format.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You can also look up Vainglorious Long as the Night. I always forget the exact name. My brain is just defaulting to Litroidvania.
Lit RPG Metroidvania, yeah.
Yeah. Lit RPG Metroidvania with a lot of care put into the formatting. Be careful about which one you're pulling up, depending upon your reader of choice. But
it will say either text replica or reflowable. Pay attention. I do mention this in the book description as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then of course there's your new venture under your different pen name, Michael Spearwater.
Mm-hmm.
I know less about that one. Go ahead and plug that, if you will.
Okay, well, the actual title is Wager for Wanderlust, which is the best title I could come up with. Many attempts to go through. It's a travelogue. It is, I think I eventually categorized it as romantasy because nothing else fit. But it's a... Let's say it's like a kind of a mid-fantasy retelling of Around the World in 80 Days, except the part of Phileas Fogg is being played by a rather outgoing bon vivant type character who is quite willing to charm and seduce his way across several continents and a couple oceans, and does so frequently.
If you're going to go around the world, you might as well enjoy the locals.
Originally written for, or originally started for a NaNoWriMo project where it was like, okay, which items am I ticking off the list this time? Okay, we got Travelogue. Okay, we have Make It Up As You Go. Oh, hell. And, okay, I needed to practice intimate scenes anyway. Okay, let's see how this works together. It did, somehow. So, even if one region actually has people speaking Tokari and B. Okay. I went deep dive on the linguistics time.
So. Yeah, I'm not. I don't even have a category for how to judge that. So, but if you're,
Tokari and
you're
B has been extinct for almost 1,000 years.
Oh, fun!
Yeah,
that would explain its odd name.
Because they don't know the actual name for it.
Yeah, it's that sounds very much like something that was assigned to it as like, we know this language existed,
mm-hmm.
but. But yeah, so yeah, that particular one is under the Michael Spearwater name. The rest are under the name Michael Yarimizu, again, Yarimizu, and are available in Kindle, Kindle Unlimited, and Dead Tree formats, depending upon what your preference is. Be sure to give them a read. There's bound to be something in that list that is to your tastes.
I'm really trying to collect them all in terms of genres, with one or two major exceptions, but I'm working on it.
Okay. And Joe, where can we find you?
Find me on Twitch and YouTube, Smoke and Joe Gamer. I'm also on Discord. I've just been streaming for RP Gamer Tuesday and Thursday nights. Been alternating between Visions of Mana and Rune Factory Guardians of Azuma.
Yeah,
that's really all I've been doing lately in that respect.
One of us.
Yes, I'm a staff member. That is correct.
No, I mean another one playing Rune Factory, Guardians of Azuma.
Oh, it's amazing! I love that game.
It's great.
Yeah. Well, so I didn't realize that there was going to be more towns to build. So, and the first town, the joke was, oh, I need to get wood for the goddess. But then I get to the second area, and now there's this other goddess who wants, she's like, I where's my sword? Get me a sword. So I don't like her as much. She's whiny. The first goddess was nice to me. I don't know. But now I'm like, oh, now I need to get a sword for the goddess. Ugh. So
yeah,
I got a
got
sword for you right
time.
Here. Yeah. You gotta have fun with it, yeah. So I've been getting some regular viewers on there and chatters, and it's actually been quite fun. And, you know, at this point, I don't know if my Twitch channel is ever going to go anywhere. I don't know if I'll ever be affiliate or anything. But at least on RP Gamer, it's like, hey, there's a bit of an audience here. I'm helping them earn a few bucks. And then, you know, sometimes they send me free stuff. So, like, hey, I got a free copy of Rune Factory. It's like, all right, cool.
Living the dream.
Yeah. Yeah. So just doing that. And, yeah, so lately... I tried playing the Battlefield 6 beta, and it's you know what, I'm playing it, I'm like, okay, yeah, this is a Battlefield game, it, you know, at this point, you know if it's for you or not, and it's like, yeah, it's very difficult, and when the enemy team gets a tank, forget it, you're just gonna die a bunch of times, and for some reason, in the space of about 1 to 2 hours, my TV glitched and reset itself 3 times.
Oh, no.
only while playing this game. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what you guys are doing, but your game's not even that good anyways. I'm not going to risk breaking my TV to play a mediocre game. So that was my experience with that. We did some Marvel Rivals last night, and I tried to play as Blade. He just got added, and he's tricky. But Phoenix is fun, and then I think I got MVP with Squirrel Girl, maybe, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Squirrel Girl, so, I think, wasn't it Punisher?
Oh, it might have been Punisher.
No, it was Squirrel Girl, yeah. No, Punisher was it the was one where you got, what do they call the losing MVP, SVP?
SVP, yeah. Yeah, the best person on the losing team is called SVP. I don't know what the S stands for, like secondary valuable player. I don't know.
Box valuable player.
So we were doing that, and let's see. Well, just today I got an itch to play Donkey Kong Bonanza again, so I just went to the Tempest layer, which I initially rushed through because I didn't like it, and I'm just finding all these bananas and fossils, and now that I have the elephant form and I bought all the upgrades, it's like I can suck up all the lava and sometimes there's things hidden in the lava that would normally kill you. Yeah. So that's been quite fun. And like I said, before I jumped on, I was listening in and you guys mentioned UFO 50. So I've talked about it before on the podcast, but it's on Switch now. So if you didn't get it on Steam, you got no excuse. Like, this is a great game.
I already bought it.
Yep. And
I have a good excuse. Playing games on PCs sucks ass.
Well, you're saying you don't have an excuse now because it's also on Switch.
Oh, yeah, it's true. Yeah. Okay, fine. Fine.
Gotcha. But, yeah, no, so I talked about it a lot when it first came out, and it's a lot of fun. So I've put about 20 hours into it, and that's from trying each game at least once. And, yeah, you're not going to like them all. But basically, to me, it's the perfect game to have on Steam Deck or Switch because you're getting 50 games in one, and it only takes up, like, a couple of gigabytes of space. So it's actually not very big. And there's a lot of like kind of arcade style games that you can just jump in, play a couple levels till you die. And, you know, there's not really a huge time commitment on a lot of these games, although they can be extremely difficult. So my personal favorites were Party House, which is almost like a card game where you have to like
card strategy thing.
Yeah. So it's just, there's this room and it's a party. You click on the door, a guest comes in. Some guests give you extra population that you use to buy other guests. Some guests give you money, which you buy to make the party bigger and have more slots for people. And some of them cause trouble. And if there's too much trouble, the cops show up and you don't get anything. If you end the party early, you get any money or population points that you've accrued. And essentially what you're doing is, as the game goes on, it's kind of
you
like
have a certain
card game.
Number of turns. yeah, like a certain number of parties in order to accrue a certain amount of points by having high enough population and money and shit.
And you eventually have to get VIPs to show up to your party. So think of it like a card game where you get to add cards to the deck as you play, and you're trying to kind of stack the deck to stop the cops from showing up. And it's, yeah. So I had a lot of fun with that one. And the other one that really stands out for me is Night Manor, which is like one of those old school point and click horror games. And it's like, wow, it's just a really cool game where you're in this creepy house and there's this guy chasing you and you're just finding different items and you got to think of how you can combine them or where you can use them. So you find a lighter, so you've got to start a fire in the fireplace, and then you get like a crowbar, you get a pair of scissors, you know, you just get all these different tools and you just got to solve a bunch of little puzzles while you're being chased by a psychopath. So actually quite a neat game. So if you beat a game, it's gold. If you get 100% completion, it's cherry. It turns red. So the cartridge for Party House is gold right now because there's a requirement for the cherry that's too hard for me. But the Night Manor, I 100%ed the game and got the there's a really good ending that you don't have to get. That's if you can somehow beat it without dying, but the good ending is where you at least solve all of the puzzles and figure out what's going on and defeat the villain. But just a huge collection. Now, one game I didn't like was Barbuda, and that's popular with speedrunners. I just thought it was a very difficult, cumbersome game.
I don't want to cut you off, but I super need to get to bed.
Yeah.
Okay. So no, just saying. UFO 50 is a nice collection of 50 games. There's bound to be something that you like. If you didn't know the premise of it, you might think these were real, like NES games. That's how believable the whole premise is. And then just as an FYE for anybody wondering, if you already own Heretic and Hexen on Steam, you already got the free upgrade to the remaster version. So I checked those out a little bit, and I'm looking to jump into that more. So that's what I got for you this week.
Yeah. You can ask us questions. You can ask us questions in the Discord. If you go to rpgamer.com and click community, that will get you a link to the RPGamer Discord. If you go to the podcast section and ask questions, we will try to answer them. You can also ask us questions in the comment section under this very episode, or if you can catch us when we're streaming, like Dear Friend Fireminer. We stream at twitch.tv/rpgamer and twitch.tv/askwheels at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Mondays. We also stream our sister show Shenanigans, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays. That is only on twitch.tv/askwheels and is usually whatever we feel like playing multiplayer that any given night. We are always happy to get more questions. Thanks once again to Fireminer for always providing us with plenty to chew on conversation-wise, but otherwise, I need to get to bed, so see you, Space Cowboys.
See ya.
See ya.
This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.
Oh my god, that was really late. You're lucky I'm still streaming.